Session number 7257, Clifford Lane, Part 11.
That was the sort of attitude, you see. That was the troops had. He could have got out of that. And they were earning, in that time, they were earning good money, you know, in the munitions factories, and so were nobles. It's only an illustration of the attitude of some of the troops, anyway.
When you went home in 1917, in 1918, at the beginning of Passchendaele, no, 1917, wasn't it? You went back in 1918, and you were wounded. How were you treated at home? Did you have good treatment?
Oh, when I was home wounded, do you mean?
Yes.
Yes, quite good. The hospital was quite... I was in Chichester, in Grainingwell Hospital, which was a mental hospital, but had been taken over by the army. Oh yes, we were treated quite well. You know, we had good food. Good food for those days, anyway. No, we were treated quite well.
Were you sort of looked after socially? Did you find that people made a fuss of you?
Well, no, there was none of that. I mean, this was getting towards the end of the war. There was very little... none of that, as far as... Well, you could... We used to be taken out... Are we near Bognor, I think, there? We used to be taken to Bognor. I was taken to Bognor with the rest about twice the time I was there. I wonder how long I was there. I must have got there about September. September, I suppose. End of September. 1917. Unfortunately for me... My wound healed up. There was still doubt about it, but I remember the doctor saying there was a specialist came around, and I remember the doctor. I was there with this wound, and he said, "This wound's doing well, isn't it?" He said, "Yes, it is." And that was all that was said. But I still didn't know what was going to happen. You see, and of course it did. It healed up. The only thing was that the arm was a bit weak still, you know. And I went from there to Ant Hill, what they call Command Depot. That was a sort of a convalescent depot, really. More treatment. I didn't have any treatment at all after I left the hospital. I had no treatment after the wound had been drained properly, you see, in Rouen. They just left the bones to heal themselves, I suppose. Anyway, I got to Ant Hill, and I was there for until about January, I suppose, perhaps, yes, January 19. 18. And then I was transferred to Crowborough, which was our depot, you know, the regimental depot. And then during the period I was at Crowborough, I'd finished my 5 year, I think it was 5 year service. And I was entitled to £15 and a month's leave. Well, that was a godsend, really. And I had a month's leave and £15. And I went back to Crowborough. And then, of course, the German advance had taken place and was still going on. And they were crying out for troops. And I was sent out again. In the end of April, near the end of April 1918.
Could I now ask you about the armistice? Can you remember the day at all when you discovered that, you know, the war was over?
Oh yes, very well. But before that happened, I was our platoon was billeted in the devastated area, in a sort of cellar, I suppose it was, and one morning. Sergeant Major came in and said to me that you have to take the platoon into some other premises because one of the men has just developed some sort of disease which might be infectious. And so the man concerned was a big fellow, and he'd gone, and they'd taken him to the hospital, you see. So we were marched off to, I marched up to Tunoff. They wanted to get rid of us because we were obviously in a sort of a state of, in a threatening state, or might be in a threatening state. So we marched to this stable. The war was over then. This was, of course, after the armistice, really. And we got to this stable and found it a stinking mess of the actual stall, manger rather, because it was a manger, was full of noisome liquid. So I had to get the men going on cleaning the whole place up. The floor itself consisted of small tiles, only about 2 or 3 inches, quite small things. So it was a sort of a ridgy affair. So we had to get that cleaned up and get something to lie on. Well, we had plenty of blankets, and we managed to lie fairly comfortable for us, because we used to hard living. And we managed to clean the place up, and we were left entirely alone for 2 or 3 weeks. Nobody came near us, so that obviously whatever this man had got, it was something pretty obnoxious, because they were frightened the people that the rest of the company were kept away from us. But whatever it was, none of our men got it. None of us was ill. We had rations brought to us every day. And eventually we were taken away. But before this happened, there was one incident. One evening, just before dark, a poor old peasant walked in, a French peasant. He said he was trying to get back to his former village. He said he was suffering from rheumatism very badly. So we set up a bed for him. We had plenty of blankets at the time, because we were fairly short of numbers, you see. We set up a bed for him. We had a good issue of rum. We gave him a good issue of rum, and he slept soundly that night. The next morning he seemed quite chirpy, really. He looked better, and he felt better. So we had a collection of money. We hadn't got much, but we gave him, I suppose, about 20 francs, which he thought was delightful, and set him on his way. I'm always pleased about that, because it seems to me that these poor devils of Frenchmen and women who were in the occupied areas and in the devastated areas, quite a lot of them were quite near the line, they never seemed to get enough credit for what they did. They really were courageous, and they had enormous endurance. Anyway, that was that. Then, as far as the armistice itself was concerned, it was a kind of anti-climax. We were too far gone, too exhausted really to enjoy it. All we could do was just go back to our billets. There was no cheering, no singing. We had no alcohol. At that particular day, we had no alcohol at all. And we simply celebrated the armistice in silence and thankfulness that it was all over. And I believe that happened quite a lot in France. It was such a sense of anticlimax. We were drained of all emotion, really. That's what it amounted to, you see. And then it was a question of when we were going to get home. Well, I had a job waiting for me, of course, as a clerk in the post office headquarters. But about two or three weeks after the armistice, I had a telegram saying that my father was very ill with the influenza epidemic that was raging at the time. I took this telegram to the officer. He said, "We can't do anything about it." He said, "We've got no transport, no sea transport. We've been told we mustn't send anybody home at all. Only wounded men." Which I thought was rather disgusting. I've been out there 3.5 years. So I couldn't attend my own father's funeral. At the time, I thought it was... But that was the rule. Nobody could go unless he was wounded. And we were then employed on a task which I thought was disgusting too. Men of like myself had had, I had to take working parties out to clear dud ammunition, dud shells, from the surrounding area. And we lost one. These shells, of course, you don't know what's going to happen to them. I mean, you wanted experts to feel, really. So one day, a friend of mine and myself, we decided we were not going to parade any more like that. We weren't going to do any more of that. When they got men there, who'd only been in France 3 or 4 months, you see? So what we did, we went out for the day. We went away for the day from the battalion. Of course, we were hauled up before the company commander. And he said to me, he said, "I could have you court-martialed for this." I couldn't say anything. He said, "But you've done some very good work in the line recently. And I'm going to simply reprimand you." The other chap, I don't know what, I think he's reduced one rank. So I was safe from a court martial because I refused to obey orders to go to this clearing up of, had to clear up all sorts of rubbish, dummy, sort of dud bombs, dud shells, which did kill and were still killing men for long after the war was over, you know, because the whole countryside was littered with lethal weapons which might go up at any time. And I can confirm this because in 1920 I took my wife, soon after we were married, to Belgium. And we stayed at the Chateau de Poitou, which had been the headquarters, as I mentioned before, for about a week. And we wanted to find the grave of her brother, which we did. But in doing so, we found that it was still dangerous, very dangerous, to travel across fields and things like that, because there were still shells, bombs, anything lying about. Every now and again there'd be an explosion where the Belgian army were destroying live shells, you see. Every now and again people would shout to us, "Stop, don't come any further." So I thought, to hell with this, I'm not going to risk my life, my wife's life and my own life again. So we stopped exploring after that. We kept to the main roads, the Menin Road. And we never had any more trouble, but it was really highly dangerous for some years after that.
Mm. What did the countryside look like?
Well, it was devastated, you see. It was, it's difficult to describe, really. It was brown, tortured earth. No, trees were, in the fighting areas, the trees were stumps no higher than that. Whole forests and woodlands were devastated. In time, the whole of the trees were destroyed. I mean, they were lopped off, they were cut off, blown off. So that in places like Thiepval, which was on the edge of woods, the woods were No longer. There were no longer. There's simply a mass of clay, upheaval of clay and tree stumps. You never could imagine a wood, because I must imagine that wood of Non-Boshan, where we first went, that must have been destroyed as well later on, because at that time it was only, you know, the war was only a few months old, and but you get years of bombardment, you get some of these heavy attacks, they simply devastated the woods altogether, and it's simply like a wasteland, a desolate wasteland. Incidentally, I've got a...
So when did you get back to England then?
I got back to England in February 1919. And I had a month's demobilisation leave, and then went back to the post office and started work in the telegraphic address section of the telephone department, or telegraph department rather. That is to say, we dealt with telegraphic addresses, you see. And at that time they'd got a lot of temporary staff who were gradually dispersed or got rid of. And eventually became a clerical officer. And then I was made executive officer later on. Not for a long time, mind you. Promotion was very, very slow in those days. And then higher executive officer. And then senior executive officer. And I was getting on towards my retiring age of 60 then, but I did have they wanted to go on a board for chief executive officer. Well, I was told that, I don't know whether I was told, but anyway, that I'd pass the board. But you see, I was nearly 60 years of age, and instead of, they wanted me to carry on, you see, but I was coming out from Westcliff to London, and I'd had enough of it. I had stayed on. Of course, they'd awarded me the MBE before that for my work on the telephone regulations, you see. That was 4 years before. That was an award I really earned that award, because I was doing work of people of higher rank than me. And not only that, for about 6 months, I suppose, what happened was I used to bring work home on Saturday afternoon. Of course, we used to work Saturday mornings, you see. I'd get home, have a meal. I might have half an hour's kit. About 3 o'clock, I would start on this work that I'd got. And I'd work till 11 o'clock Saturday night. And that happened for week after week. And very often, instead of coming home, they'd say to me, "Would you mind taking a meeting?" That's how I was acting as secretary for a meeting of high up people, you see. This afternoon we've got to have a meeting, and this was Saturday afternoon. And you can telephone your wife, there won't be any charge for it. The difference between the conditions of those days, we never got any overtime for all the work. I'd done hours and hours, and we all did. Not all the people engaged on that particular job. Sir John Ricks, who's now retired, he as well would be working. Everybody took work home and worked. Every hour civil servant, I suppose they do still, the administrative class, they take work home, and they used to look worn out, absolutely worn out, working at home at night, 3 or 4 nights a week. Anyway, I did this on this Saturday afternoon for about 6 months, I suppose. Well, eventually I had to go to the House of Commons with Sir John, not Sir John Rex, Sir John somebody. He was the solicitor of the post office. I had to go to the House of Commons with him. I used to go up, of course, I was treated like the higher ups. I was taken by a car with a chauffeur, and we'd go to the House of Commons. Well, first of all, we went to the Parliamentary Council. Everybody was overworked in those days, and this Parliamentary Council, I'd be with the solicitor, Sir Clement Hallam his name was, and his subordinates, and the director of telecoms, all very high, top brass people. And he'd already, we had to tell him our ideas about the bill, the telephone bill, you see. And he was a very irritable bloke. And anyway, eventually, we went up there twice, I think, to his office. And then it came to the House. The bill was eventually published, and it had its first and second reading. I think it was at the committee stage that I came into it. And as I don't know whether he recorded that or not, that Les Edwards was the Postmaster General. And we went to the Net Edwards' room, was called the Minister's Room, and the debate was on the committee stage, I think, or it was a committee of the whole House. But anyway, there were about 40 members there. Boyd Carpenter led for the Tories, and I told you about the Solicitor General was there as well, Sir Frank Soskus. And eventually the bill was passed, but the Labour Party then had only got about 5 or 6 majority, but they managed to get the bill passed. And that was that. Well, that was why I received the MBE. Mm.
Did you get any medals for your war service?
No, only the 1914 Star. That was given to anybody. Doesn't matter if you're infantry or not, you got that if you were in France before the 22nd of November 1914. That was all.
When you look back on this period of your life, how important was it, do you think, to your life?
The war,
yes.
Well, I suppose it was. Well, it's difficult to say, really. It's difficult to say what would have happened had there been no war.
Did you learn anything from it?
Well, I learned a lot about human nature, yes, certainly.
Did you learn a lot about yourself?
Well, I don't know, not really, I suppose. I learned that I had the physical endurance to last out through cold and wet and that sort of thing, although I got pneumonia once, but nevertheless I survived it. I must have had a strong constitution, you see, to have survived the hold of that. And we were exhausted, and no doubt nervously exhausted after the war for a time. And all we wanted to do was a quiet life, really, you see. But eventually, I was never ambitious, really. Promotions always came without any. No, I made the effort, of course. I'll tell you for one example. When I was a clerical officer, there was an executive officer who was complaining about being overworked. And one of the staff officers, senior staff I suppose, or anyway, senior staff officers, came around to the clerical officers and asked, would anybody help this particular executive officer? I volunteered to help him. So that indicates that I was willing to do anything like that, you see. And I did. I did quite a few jobs for him, the executive jobs. And I remember one job it entailed a certain amount of research and that sort of thing, and I drew up my memorandum. I first of all had to give it to this executive officer. He passed it on to a higher executive officer, you see. Now, this higher executive officer was a really eccentric sort of chap. And he called me in one day and he said, what about this memorandum you've done for Birkett? And I said, well, what about it? He said, well, he hadn't touched it. He hadn't altered or amended in any way. I said, well, perhaps he didn't think he needed amendment. And they said, well, I don't know. He said, well, about opening telegraph offices in Scotland on Sunday morning. That's what the whole thing was about. And it was quite narky because, you see, because the thing hadn't been criticised, there was bound to be something wrong with it. And that was the sort of thing. But anyway, every job that I did for this chap was taken by him, and he hardly touched it, you see. And eventually I got my promotion to higher executive officer.
Going back to the war, did you ever get a pension or anything?
No, I got no pension. I didn't apply for one, you see. I could have applied for one. I knew afterwards that quite a lot of people got pensions for neurasthenia. It was nervous exhaustion, really, you know. And I think I could have got one for that. But I never applied for one. And you had to apply within 7 years, I think, you see. I didn't apply for one. I know people that got pensions for bronchitis. It never left the country, never went out of England, got pensions for life. It was a racket, really, you know. But I never got a pension for anything. I didn't apply.
I know earlier you said that there were sort of different experiences of war, those like yourself right up the infantry.
Oh, yes, well, you must take that as a truism that the only people that really experienced the 1940 war in all its horror was the front-line infantry. But there's no question about that at all. It won't be accepted, of course. The Royal Field Artillery were the next nearest to the line, you see. But there's no doubt that the only man that really saw the 1914 war in all its horror was the front-line infantrymen. And that was why they were called the PBI, Poor Bloody Infantry. You've heard that expression, haven't you? And it was fully justified. I've got no doubt about that at all. I mean, people at brigade, even at battalion, well, battalion, of course, were in the... But people at battalion headquarters didn't go over the top, you know. They don't go over the top. People at brigade headquarters didn't know anything about it, really. They might have come on the shell fire now and again. People at divisional headquarters were living, compared with us, living the life of Riley, you see. There's no question about that at all. And people on these big guns, there were 15-inch guns out there eventually, they were miles behind the line, you know. And the Royal Army Medical Corps never came into action. They never come under rifle, very rarely come under rifle fire. They were there, but the first people to attend you were your own stretcher bearers. They were stretcher bearers there. If anybody attended, and you were lucky to get any attention, if there was a heavy lot of wounded, they always attended to the officers first, you see. And when you got to the RAMC, you were getting out of the, away from the danger zone. So you can take it there. I mean, well, you've only got to realise, you can realise that if you're there and they are just about 25, 30, 40 or 200 yards away, there's nothing between you, you see. All these other people had men well in front of them, you see. And you never knew what you were going to encounter. You'd go out on a patrol. And you might find nothing. You very often found nothing. But you were going right round. You'd make a patrol like this, which we did anyway. Go right round. So your left-hand man, if you were going from that direction, would be almost on the German wire, you see. And listening patrols too, you go well out, 50, 60 yards out, and you stay there. But you've got to remember that the infantrymen had nobody in front of them except the enemy. And that the enemy at any time might make an attack. And that not only that, he would the front line, if they were very close together, you wouldn't get shell fire on the front line, because it quite likely hit his own troops, you see. You'd get that under support line, but practically the whole danger zone was anywhere from about 300 or 400 yards from the front line back 300 or 400 yards. And it was all occupied by the infantry, you see.
Well, Mr. Lane, thank you very much indeed.
Well, I'm afraid you wanted to go, will you?